Franklin Delano Roosevelt has been criticized for not doing more to save Jews from the Holocaust. But in his new book from Thunder's Mouth Press, Robert Rosen argues that given the political realities of the day, FDR led a daring crusade to stop Hitler and the spread of fascism. He's called his book Saving the Jews, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Holocaust. I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Rosen back to my show today. Hello.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So what's the most common criticism of FDR's actions in regard to the Jews?
Well, the two really hot-button issues are the SS St. Louis and the bombing of Auschwitz. And the St. Louis, of course, there was a movie, The Voyage of the Damned, and people are familiar with that. And it's turned into a huge story, most of which is not true. And when I say that, it's you run into people at parties, and they say all those people went back to Germany, went to Auschwitz. Well, of course, the St. Louis sailed in May of 39. It got back to Germany.
It was after Kristallnacht.
It was after Kristallnacht, so people were trying to get out. It sails in May of 39. And, of course, World War II hasn't started. The Final Solution hasn't started. And so when the ship gets to Cuba, it's turned away for internal Cuban reasons. That's a long story. But our State Department...
There's a lot of extortion, actually, involved.
Exactly. People don't realize the Holocaust is also about robbery. And
people were asked to pay a lot of money to get into Cuba, and then it wasn't enough money, and money was taken, and nobody knows who took it.
A lot of thievery. But with regard to the Roosevelt administration, the State Department used all of its efforts to convince the Cuban government to let the Jews in. A lot of people don't know that. And the most important thing is the American Jewish leadership, the Joint, the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, sent a lawyer down there with a suitcase full of cash to bribe the Cuban government. The American Jewish community was fighting to save these people. Well, what happens is, first of all, some of them get off in Cuba. 288 of the 900 get off in Great Britain and survive the war. And the rest of them go to Antwerp and go to Belgium and the Netherlands and France. They don't go back to Germany.
But after they were refused entry into Cuba, the St. Louis headed north following the Florida coastline in hopes that the United States would accept the refugees. And it turns out FDR signed an order to deny entry of the ship.
I don't know where you got that information.
June 4th, 1939. My understanding is that it was because his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, was vehemently opposed to allowing them in, along with Southern Democrats, including from your state of South Carolina.
Well, I've never read that anywhere. He never signed any order because... I don't know what your information is, but I certainly no history that I've ever read has ever said that. They couldn't come to the United States because we had very strict immigration laws. And that goes back to the 20s when people didn't want communists and Catholics and Jews coming to the country. So they weren't turned away. They simply didn't have the ability to enter. But the most important point here is that the United States government was trying to get them settled in Cuba, and we did. We, the United States government and the American Joint Distribution Committee, saved every person on the St. Louis. They went to England and they went to Antwerp. So they were settled back. And if World War II hadn't started, the ones who had visas could have come to the U.S.
So the movie came out and really affected our sense of the history of this story?
That's another complicated question.
When did it come out?
The movie was out in the 70s, but I think this whole business with the Holocaust, you know, when I was growing up in the 50s, people really didn't talk much about the Holocaust. And I think people have gotten angrier and angrier about the Holocaust. It's gotten to be very symbolic. It's gotten to be a part of the Jewish religion, really. And so people now are angrier and more emotional about it than they were in the 50s. And so our whole consciousness about the Holocaust, I think, is something that's taken place in this country. And then people are looking to blame everybody. And, you know, Elie Wiesel says that we're all to blame for the Holocaust. Well, you know, my father wasn't to blame. He was fighting the Japanese in the Pacific.
So why do you think people were less concerned in the 50s than they've become?
Well, you know, most people, when they've been victimized prior to the 70s, were ashamed of it. I mean, if your ancestors were slaves or you were killed, it was something to be embarrassed about. Victimology has become popular since the 60s.
But if you go to the Holocaust Museum, there are these presentations on video at the end, and there's a whole... video devoted to FDR and the fact that Jews were not allowed in the United States. Well, couldn't he have issued executive orders?
No, we have statutes, right? Look, the best example is look what's going on right now. All of these illegal aliens, we're having a debate in the Senate and the House. You notice that George Bush cannot issue an order allowing everybody in Mexico to come to the United States. See, the Congress passes these laws. Roosevelt couldn't touch those laws.
I guess the problem is that in the case of Jews, they were threatened with death, and we do have laws now anyway that allow people whose lives are threatened in their homelands to be given special access.
Well, one, that's reading history backwards. We didn't have laws like that then. And number two, they weren't threatened with death. See, that's the fallacy. St. Louis occurs after Kristallnacht. Well, that's not the final solution. That's Jews being beat up and their stores being wrecked. Well, that went on in Europe for 2,000 years. There was nothing new about that. And so they were not going back to certain death. The Holocaust hadn't started yet, and that's the whole point. The Holocaust doesn't start. The final solution doesn't start until 1942, 3 years after these passengers return.
Where has the harshest criticism of FDR come from?
Well, it's a complicated thing. I think, one, people want to refight a lot of battles, and they want to make everybody feel very guilty about the Holocaust because that drums up support for the State of Israel. That drums up support. It brings, Jewish people back to synagogues. It drums up support for a lot of causes to rescue people. I mean, in other words, the Holocaust was so horrible, and we feel guilty that we didn't do more. And these things can be used. They can be used for fundraising events. They can be used for religious reasons. They can be used for political causes. And I think, really, the Holocaust, people have become obsessed with it, I think.
But what's gained by saying FDR is the main culprit in the story?
I think there's a tendency among certain historians to want to blame the American government for every kind of ill that there is. There's a political advantage to be gained in that, number one. Number two, a lot of the people writing this history have an agenda. They identify with the people who are fighting with Roosevelt. They identify with this fellow Hillel Cook, Peter Bergson, who was a member of the Irgun. And there's a lot of subtext to this. There's the Irgunist debate with the Haganah and the internal fights in American politics. And there's also a dimension in the American Jewish community of this anger at German Jewish elitists and Reform Jews. There's kind of a class argument going on.
Well, American Jews at that time were rather ambivalent themselves, weren't they? They were afraid to stir things up because Father Coughlin was on the radio. There was an awful lot of open anti-Semitism in this country.
There was, and I think I think a lot of Jews were afraid to speak up. But the fact is, they did speak up, and that's another myth. It's a myth. I mean, we're down in near Wall Street. It was a huge demonstration. Hundreds of thousands of people in the 30s demonstrated against the Nazis. Rabbi Wise, the American Jewish Committee, they did speak out. There was a boycott of German goods. So this business about the American Jews being cowards, that's also exaggerated for reasons, I think, inside the Jewish community.
Alan Dershowitz, who wrote the afterword to your book, says that it often takes two or three revisions to get history right. Is this the second revision, you think?
Well, the first version, of course, was that Roosevelt was a godlike hero who could do no wrong. That obviously wasn't accurate. Then we went to the other extreme. Arthur Morris, while 6 Million died, wrote a book that is just full of inaccuracies. We had an exaggerated point of view there. Other scholars have taken these positions. My book is really designed to look at what they've said and to criticize and to point out how the revisionists are wrong.
Is there any new research into this?
In my book?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the St. Louis, for example, I looked at the papers of the American Joint Distribution Committee, that we remember, which was the committee that saved the passengers on the St. Louis. And I looked at those records. I don't remember any other historians looking at them.
Well, what happened in Antwerp? Were people safe in Antwerp?
Of course. Well, look, it's 1939. Poland is not invaded until September. So the Jews leave Antwerp. They go to France, the Netherlands, and Belgium. Well, they're perfectly safe. They're as safe as anybody else. Listen, Otto Frank went to Amsterdam in 1933. He's living in the Netherlands. Anne Frank's uncle left the Netherlands, went to Palestine, came back. He said there's nothing there but Arabs and Jews. The Jews could move around in 39. The Holocaust really hadn't started yet.
Roosevelt is generally regarded as one of the greatest presidents. Do you think that these accusations tarnish his reputation in any way?
Oh, absolutely. I think, and I have to laugh because Jonathan Alter was on, I saw him on a show the other day, and he's written this book, The Defining Moment, and he doesn't even talk about this issue, but, you know, two or three people in the audience get up to ask him about the bombing of Auschwitz. And so, yes, I think particularly Jewish people, but the Holocaust is such a hot button issue that I think it has hurt Roosevelt's reputation terribly.
I want to get to the bombing of Auschwitz,
yeah,
but first let's talk about some other things. My guest is Robert N. Rosen. His book, Saving the Jews, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Holocaust, is published by Thunder's Mouth Press. What were the immigration policies in the United States at this time?
Well, see, I think that's critical to an understanding of the issues. Remember, America took in unlimited immigrants from Poland, from Italy, and from Russia, Jews, Italians, Slavs. And all of a sudden, the makeup of the country changed between 1880 and 1920. So here you have a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant country swamped with Italians and communists from Russia and Jews, so many of them socialists, anarchists. And there's a lot going on in America that people seem to forget about when they talk about the Holocaust. You have the Haymarket bombing, the anarchists. You have the Red Scare in the 1920s.
Sacco and Vanzetti.
Sacco and Vanzetti. You know, the country is terrified of all these crazy immigrants. And it's not just the Jews. It's Italians. It's the Poles. And it's also an anti-Catholicism thing. So, 1924, we enact a new immigration law. We cut out all immigration. Doesn't matter what the Statue of Liberty says and all that business. Doesn't mean anything after 1924 because now America is no longer a place that you can come.
So people were turned away indiscriminately or selectively?
They were. We had a quota system that was based on giving preference to Northern Europeans. It was a sort of a racist system. It was the British, the Germans, the Northern Europeans. You know, the 150,000 slots, 250 could come from Spain. So we had these very strict immigration laws, and I think that's what people do not understand about this debate. Then, of course, you have the Great Depression, 1929. Now you have tens of millions of people unemployed, out on the street, and I think people also underestimate the despair of the Great Depression.
But there were also any number of celebrated Jews who wound up being accepted into the United States. Did we pick and choose? Einstein, yes, but not some person who was just your everyday citizen?
Well, we did pick and choose because, for example, even in the height of World War II and when the Jews were in the most danger, we did give preference, for example, to rabbis and to rabbinical students. I mean,
but also Hannah Arendt and Theodor Adorno. And
they came earlier. You know, remember Einstein came to America 33, 34. 200,000 of the 300,000 German and Austrian Jews who fled came to the United States. So it's really the people who came earlier. But there was a preference for intellectuals, and there was a preference for religious people and labor leaders and some other categories.
What was the Oswego experiment?
Well, that was something where some people felt that if we could just open America to refugees, that we could bring more people in. Roosevelt gave it a try. He said, okay, we'll open up this fort and we'll let some people come in. It was extremely controversial. But remember, the people who came in had already escaped from Hitler. Remember, we weren't saving anybody. These were people who would have ended up in Italy, but we let them come to the United States.
And what about the Rubley Plan? Was that something that originated with Roosevelt?
It appears that it did. There was a plan to ransom German Jewry. Now remember, once again, this is earlier. This is in the 30s where...
Roosevelt's already president.
He's already president, but this is before the war. It's important to point out what happens before and after the war.
But Jews were already being discriminated against. It was quite apparent that whether there was going to be a final solution or not, that it was going to be a very difficult time for Jews in Europe.
Not necessarily. Not until Kristallnacht. That's what I don't agree with that. What were they doing in Germany? They said Jews could only live in certain places. They could only have certain jobs. They couldn't marry Christians. Well, these have been laws in Russia, in Poland, and many other countries for many years. This was very familiar to Jews to be discriminated against in that manner. It was not a prelude to the Holocaust. It simply was a continuation of European anti-Semitism. That's what it appeared at the time. Now, the Rubley Plan, the Germans said, get the Jews out. There was no talk of killing the Jews. It was run them out. Roosevelt saw the Jews were in trouble, and he tried to get American Jews to put up the money to bribe the German government to let the Jews out. And it fell apart because World War II started, and it never got anywhere.
Did FDR ever have any contact with Hitler?
No. Not to my knowledge. I don't believe so.
And when do you think that he first started to realize just how great a threat Hitler posed?
Well, that first of all, Roosevelt hated Germans, and I think people have to understand that anyone who says Roosevelt's an anti-Semite doesn't know what they're talking about. But if you want to say Roosevelt detested Germans, that's true, and that was the result of his experience with Germans in World War I. I think he realized early in 37, certainly, that Hitler was a madman and really crazy. And he had no respect for him. He read Mein Kampf in German. You know, Roosevelt could speak French and German. And so I think by 38, he realizes that Hitler is really a danger to the world very early on. In fact, that's Roosevelt's greatest accomplishment, is that long before other people, he and Churchill saw the threat of Adolf Hitler.
But he was in power, and Churchill wasn't in power until later.
He was in power, but he was in power in a country that was so isolationist. Remember, Charles Lindbergh went to Yale and Dartmouth, and thousands of kids cheered, "Keep us out of war."
And was that because of memories of World War I, or a sense of American uniqueness, or was it because at that time it was a lot easier to be openly anti-Semitic and see any potential war with Hitler as involving the Jews?
I think you're confusing several different things. I don't think this had anything to do with the Jews. This had to do with what the disillusionment of World War I.
Well, Lindbergh
was an
anti-Semitic side.
But he was appealing to a majority, a great majority of American people who said, look, we do not want to be in a war. We fought this war in World War I. It was a bad war. The munitions industry got us into it. There was a big conspiracy about it. And people said, we're not going to go fight in Europe. Forget the Jews. If Hitler had never said anything about the Jews, Americans would not have gotten into World War II. I mean, until Pearl Harbor.
Even though there was Father Coughlin and there were all sorts of other people who were really popular in the country at the time.
There was anti-Semitism, but the Nazis didn't resonate in the United States. I'm from the South, and people don't realize this. Southerners hated the Nazis. They didn't buy into this anti-Semitic business. There was a certain level of anti-Semitism in America that was acceptable, but not this violent. Remember, the American people reacted to Kristallnacht with great anger.
I hate to differ with you, but the KKK hated Jews, Catholics, and blacks.
They did.
And I think they hated the Jews almost as much as they hated
the
blacks.
They did, but they didn't represent the majority of people in America. I mean, the KKK was anti-Semitic, and they were out there. But look, Roosevelt had Jews in his cabinet. There were Jews in the Congress. There were two Jews on the Supreme Court. The KKK didn't run the country.
We're going to take a little break, and we will come back with more with Robert Rosen. His book, Saving the Jews, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Holocaust, with a foreword by Gerhard Weinberg and an afterword by Alan Dershowitz, published by Thunder's Mouth Press.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We're back with Robert N. Rosen, whose latest book is Saving the Jews, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Holocaust, published by Thunder's Mouth Press. We received a call from someone who remembers something I saw at the Holocaust Museum. He said that FDR is considered anti-Semitic by some people because of letters he wrote to Cordell Hull, which are on display at the Holocaust Museum. He said in those letters he wasn't going to let the Jews in.
You know, there's a letter where he agrees with Hull after the Bermuda conference that we have to be very careful to comply with the immigration laws and we can't take any extraordinary steps to do this and that. But remember, when a president is writing a secretary of state on an issue like that, you know, that's done so that the newspapers and the Congress can't jump all over him. So he wasn't that's not anti-Semitic. As I say, these immigration laws were immutable. And Hull and Roosevelt were scared to death of challenging Congress on them. So
what was the role of Robert Morgenthau, his Secretary of Treasury, in all of this? Was he advising for more involvement?
Henry Morgenthau Jr., who also, by the way,
father of Robert Morgenthau,
who has been vilified by these same historians that I'm criticizing, vilified as being a self-hating Jew, as being somebody who was embarrassed about being Jewish. But all of a sudden, he woke up in 1944 and all of a sudden was concerned about the Jews. None of this is true. Morgenthau's family built a synagogue for Stephen Wise. Morgenthau was concerned about the St. Louis, and he had Roosevelt's total cooperation. Morgenthau was in charge of the Coast Guard. And when you say the story about the Coast Guard keeping the St. Louis away, it was Morgenthau was in charge of the Coast Guard. He was the Secretary of the Treasury. He was also a big contributor to the Joint. And this this big, rich, German, affluent, assimilated Jewish community was very concerned about the Jews of Europe. So, yes, he was on Roosevelt all the time. Now, he went to Roosevelt and convinced Roosevelt to create the War Refugee Board, which really committed America to trying to save the Jews of Europe.
So let's get to the whole matter of bombing the concentration right. camps, or at least the rail lines to them.
Well, let me dispatch the rail lines pretty quickly. Nobody who knows anything about military history thinks that bombing a rail line accomplishes anything. And here's why. First of all, in World War II, it's a very time-consuming task. It's not like today with these smart missiles. You've got to risk men's lives to take photographs. Then you bomb the railway line. Then the Germans come back an hour later and repair it. Okay. Plus, there were 7 or 8 railway lines from Hungary to Auschwitz, which is what the debate is about. So nobody who knows anything about this thinks bombing the rail lines really would accomplish much. Okay. And military historians, of course, think it's ridiculous. The D-Day invasion, we had to bomb rail lines continuously, day after day after day. And by the way, this whole debate about Auschwitz occurred May to November of 44 when our airplanes were being used in support of the Normandy invasion. So the railway lines is not even an argument. Now, as to bombing the camps, there's a huge debate about whether we should or should not have bombed the camps, or whether we could have bombed the camps. A lot of Roosevelt's defenders say it couldn't be done. Well, I don't agree with that. It could have been done because it was done. We did bomb the camps. What everyone has missed in the debate and what I found was that no Jewish leaders were in favor of bombing the camps. I say no. A few on the fringes, like this Hillel Kook character, is a member of the Irgun, who no one was paying any attention to. But Leon Kubowitzki of the World Jewish Congress, David Ben-Gurion, the Jewish Agency executive, you can hardly accuse them of being anti-Semites. Kubowitzki wrote a letter to the head of the War Refugee Board. He says, "The destruction of the death installations cannot be done by bombing from the air, as the first victims would be the Jews who are gathered in these camps." So the point of it is, this is a debate created by historians 30 years later for whatever reason they want to create the debate.
So it was a tactical decision, put the military's resources toward one thing rather than another thing?
Well, not to be flippant, but we put our military resources towards winning the war. And, of course, bombing Auschwitz would not have contributed anything to winning the war.
You sit on the board of the American Jewish Historical Society. Do the people there agree with what you've written?
My book is pretty controversial. I've spoke at a function of the American Jewish Historical Society. Most people did not agree, but most people haven't read the book. I think this is something that people, need to read. In other words, people have read David Wyman's book, The Abandonment of the Jews. They've read other books, many, many books, which I think are not correct in the way they view the facts. My opinions are different. And so I'm attacking an established view. And I think the reader has to have an open mind.
So the two big issues are the SS St. Louis and the bombing of Auschwitz?
Well, there are plenty of other issues. One of the issues is that we didn't speak out. You heard this all your life. We were silent when the Holocaust was going on. And, of course, this is another myth. In December of 1942, Franklin Roosevelt issues a declaration on the massacre of the Jews in which he condemns, and I'm quoting, the cold-blooded extermination of the Jews of Europe. So when people say we didn't know, we did know. We couldn't do anything about it. It was 1942. We were losing the Battle of the Atlantic. Roosevelt threatened the Germans continuously. We're going to try you. We're going to try war criminals. That's the origin of the Nuremberg trials. He did everything, in my opinion, that he reasonably could have done to save the Jews of Europe.
And did Harry Truman continue those policies?
Well, that's a whole other story. Roosevelt's position on Palestine was very ambivalent. He was in favor of it, but he saw the danger to the Jews. He was scared to death of what would happen. He tried to convince Ibn Saud in the last few weeks of his life to just let the Jews have a little bit of land, and Saud just let him have it and explain how the Muslims actually felt about the Jews. So he backed off temporarily. Truman knew that Roosevelt was in favor of a Jewish state, but Truman had to come to that himself, and that's really not a story about Roosevelt.
And Truman had his own attitudes. He's on the one hand, he seems to have been rather sympathetic. On the other hand, he
right.
is known to have made some pretty blatant anti-Semitic remarks.
He did, but this is part of the American character. On the one hand, the Jews are seen in this stereotypical way, at least at that time. But on the other hand, there's a great admiration by Christians for the Jewish people, the Jewish homelands, and Truman had all these feelings.
And growing up in the South, you didn't experience any of those negative feelings?
No, this is one of the big myths, I think, of America, that the South is a big anti-Semitic place. I mean, I grew up in Charleston. You know, our synagogue is the oldest synagogue in the United States, except for the one in Touro, Rhode Island. My congregation goes back to 1749.
Although there was the lynching of a Jewish man accused.
There was. But that was in Georgia. You know, that's not South Carolina.
Oh, I see. That's not. That's the South, or that's a
that's
different
Georgians.
South.
They're a different group of people.
What's your next book about?
I don't really know. I'm so exhausted with this, and I want to get out, and I really want to work on this book. And there's a character in this book named Oscar Cox, who I'm toying with the idea of writing a book. He was born a Jew, and then married a Christian woman, never told his children he was Jewish. He probably is the man who came up with the idea of the War Refugee Board. So here's someone who denies his Jewish heritage, doesn't even tell his children he's Jewish, but yet is so driven to save the Jews of Europe. And so that's a story that appeals to me.
Robert N. Rosen is an attorney in Charleston, South Carolina, and the author of A Short History of Charleston, Confederate Charleston, and an Illustrated History of the City and the People During the Civil War, The Jewish Confederates, most recently Charleston, A Crossroads of History, with Isabella Leland. And now, Saving the Jews, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Holocaust, published by Thunder's Mouth Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. There's some more information, if you don't mind my plugging the book, at www.savingthejews.com.